Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Tom Woods Show. This is episode 2426, and I'm delighted to welcome back our old friend Jay Bhattacharya, who is not only professor of medicine at Stanford University, and not only quite unwilling, I suppose, or let's say quite unexpected participant on the national stage all of a sudden under very, very unusual conditions. But Jay, you are an interdisciplinary kind of scholar of the sort of whom we needed many over the past few years, but had sadly few.
I have a background in medicine, of course, but I also have a PhD in economics. And I have to say, like, in the early days of the pandemic, it was striking how unfriendly the environment was for anyone who had a background in economics. Unless you supported lockdowns, then you were invited. Otherwise, you were some monster that was prioritizing economy over lives. Even as you were saying, look, from just a straight epidemiological point of view, public health point of view, the lockdowns are harming people, hurting lives.
There was always this, what I thought was a false dichotomy from the beginning. It was a caricature of what people like you and me were saying, that on the one hand, some people were concerned about human life and other people were concerned about, quote, the economy. Now, first of all, that isn't true at all. I was concerned about overall health from a bird's eye view, that there are more concerns than just one thing. But also, the economy is not just the stock market or greedy profit-seeking people. The economy is a delicate latticework of buyers, sellers, suppliers, capital goods, consumer goods, goods provided to us by nature, whereby over the entire globe, we informally cooperate to make possible the standard of living we enjoy. And I've heard it said that all the wealth existing in the world now corresponds to about 3 years of current production. So it would really, really amount to a devastating deprivation if we were just to shut the economy off. But I think the problem in part was that the other side wasn't really listening to us, but also I think they had a kind of, I don't mean to be unkind to them, but a juvenile understanding of what the economy is.
That was what struck me too, Tom. In fact, I share your vision of how an economy actually, what's it for and what actually functions. Right, it's beyond our understanding, actually. It's so complicated. All these intricate web of relationships. And of course, you can like talk about this in many ways, but one way I find useful is to think about what happened as the world essentially globalized in the sense of more intricate trade relations over the last 40, 50 years. One outcome of that was a lifting of a billion people out of poverty. And mainly because what happened is that some poor economies reorganized their economies to better fit in with the rest of the world. What that meant is that some people moved from working, you know, selling coconuts into people in cities to some other job that gave them a higher wage, lifting them out of poverty. But that job required that it fit into the global economy. When we locked down, essentially what we told the rich countries of the world, told the poor countries, is that we tricked you. You reorganize your work, reorganize your economies to fit in, but ha-ha, we don't really care about you anymore because we're scared about COVID. And all of those trade relationships ended almost abruptly for, you know, we call them supply chain disruptions, but what they really were was a disruption in the lives of billions of people, poor people. And, you know, it's not like it wasn't warranted. Like the World Bank was saying 100 million people would be thrown into dire poverty, less than $2 a day, less of income. That was in like April or May 2020. The UN World Food Program is saying 130 million people would be thrown into dire food insecurity, which is a polite way of saying starving. We made these decisions despite warnings that we were going to starve 100 million or more poor people around the world about lockdowns. The lockdowns disrupted the economies, and that disrupted not just the livelihoods, but the health and well-being, leading to hundreds of thousands or millions of kids being thrown into starvation. Families having to make decisions like, okay, I'm going to sell my kid into sexual slavery or marry them off as children or put them into child labor instead of sending them to school, which was closed anyways, or else my kids will starve. We did that to people worldwide because we disrupted the economies. And it was really clear from the earliest days that there was no moral center to the decision to lock down. It was just simply, let's pull up the drawbridge and protect ourselves, we in the rich countries of the world, at the expense of everybody else.
Now, normally when somebody comes out with a new book, and I still hold out hope someday for the Jay Bhattacharya volume on all this, it's an opportune moment to bring people on and talk to them. But in this case, you have a debate coming up at the Soho Forum in New York. And so in this case, that's an opportune moment for you to come on. And so I do want to talk about not the debate per se, but the, you know, the issues that are at the heart of it, because this has obviously occupied a great deal of your energies and attention and life for a great many months now. So I'd like to read the resolution that you'll be debating and then just talk about this. But before we get to that, I want to point out that the Soho Forum, which is thesohoforum.org, and the debate's happening December 17th in New York City. You can get tickets and go, and it's a great time. It's conducted according to the Oxford style, which means that the audience is polled on how they stand on the resolution before and after the debate, so you have an objective winner, whoever moves more people in the direction of his own opinion. So I guess my initial question, Jay, is not a scientific one at all. It's, do you ever worry that maybe you might lose?
I mean, you have to engage whether you expect to win or lose. I think in intellectual life, and especially someone who sits in a professorship at a prestigious university, we have an obligation to say what we believe and think, whether we think people are going to be persuaded or not, just because simply because that's what we're persuaded based on my analysis and my experience and so on. So I'm not so worried about winning or losing, Tom. I am worried about the broader impact of this. You're going to read the debate resolutions. I won't stomp on that, but I'll just say that the debate resolution, I think, is at the center of whether our civilization can continue in a constructive way or not. And so I do worry about losing the broader policy argument, because I think the forces arrayed against us on this issue are powerful and amoral. And if we lose the policy argument, I mean, the debate is not such an important thing, but the policy argument more generally, I worry very much about the future of our society, especially for my children.
As do I. I've got five daughters, and I think about these sorts of things a lot. Let me read the debate resolution, and then we can start talking about it. So the making of national internet policy was hindered rather than helped by the July 4th federal court ruling that restricted the Biden administration's communications with social media platforms. So you, of course, are arguing the negative in that case, in the case of this debate. So let's start, first of all, with a question I've always wanted to ask you. We know now that it wasn't entirely a dragnet policy toward absolutely everybody who had a dissident thought. They actually named particular names of people whose opinions should be suppressed in one way or another. And yours was one of those names. So what I'd like to know is, do you remember the exact moment that you found out that you, Jay Bhattacharya, a humble and quiet scholar at Stanford, had been targeted specifically by name?
It came out over the course of some time, but I think probably the moment where it just dawned on me unmistakably was when I saw Barry Weiss. Elon Musk had just bought Twitter. I think it was like November 2022, last year, about a full year away. He invited Barry Weiss and some other reporters to come to Twitter headquarters and like trawl through the Twitter databases. And she had looked me up, and there was a picture of me in the Twitter database with the words, you know, the little box, trends blacklist underneath it. I was put on a blacklist by Twitter. Elon invited me to go visit Twitter, and I saw what Twitter had done. And I asked them to go crawl back to figure out when was I put on the blacklist. It turns out I was put on the blacklist in August of 2021 when I first joined Twitter. All I tweeted was the Great Barrington Declaration. And of course, there was previous to that, there was the revelation that the head of the National Institute of Health had called for a devastating takedown of me and my Great Barrington Declaration colleagues, you know, professors from Harvard and Oxford, calling us fringe epidemiologists, leading to like essentially hit pieces by the Washington Post, New York Times, falsely accusing us of wanting to let the virus rip when we were calling for better focused protection of vulnerable older people. So it was really clear that there were government actors that were abusing their power to destroy any intellectual opposition to their policies, even before the Elon Musk purchase of Twitter and the Twitter blacklist revelation. But that just put a nail on it. And then there was the Missouri versus Biden case, on which this debate topic hinges. And that really opened the door to what the government was doing. Tom, it's not just that they named particular people, which they absolutely did. The government would go to Twitter and to Facebook and Reddit or whatever and say to them, look, if you don't censor these people, then we're going to take regulatory action. But they would do more than that. they would say, you have to censor these ideas if you have these themes. And then they've outsourced it to places like Stanford, the Stanford Internet Observatory, to develop essentially like trawl net algorithms to say, here's the whole range of things you should be censoring. Here are the bad misinformation themes that are coming up. Ironically, many of those misinformation themes turned out to be absolutely true. So the government outsourced its censorship, laundered its censorship activities to private entities like Stanford. And then the government directly went to companies like Twitter, to social media, and said, look, you better censor these people and these ideas very broadly, or else, you know, because, you know, just to give a concrete example, turns out that Facebook needed the Biden administration to negotiate with the EU regarding data security, right? Because the EU essentially has all these regulations that puts Facebook business model at, you know, essentially a direct threat. And so what the Biden administration told Facebook, in effect, was that if you don't listen to us on censorship, we're not going to negotiate on your behalf in front of the EU, and your company will get destroyed. It was such an obvious direct violation of the American First Amendment that the federal judges that have looked at this, and this doesn't include the July 4th ruling by the judge Terry Dowdy in Louisiana, but also a 3-judge panel in the Fifth Circuit, they both mentioned, like Dowdy calls it a ministry of truth, basically pointing to Orwell's 1984. That's the kind of activity. The 3-judge panel essentially endorses that view. That is essentially the biggest violation of the American First Amendment, certainly in this century, maybe even in 100 years. It is absolutely shocking to me looking at the range of evidence that has been developed. And so I look forward to that ruling. I actually look forward to the debate because I'm curious to see what my opponent, she's the one that suggested the wording of the debate topic, I think. The word hindered, like what does it mean to hinder internet policy? Hindering internet policy such that the American government can violate the First Amendment at scale? That's really, I think, what is the content of what the debate is about.
Well, one of the arguments has been, now you mentioned that we have more than just the ruling from Judge Dowdy. That's true. But one of the arguments that's been made, although I thought that ruling was brilliant, now maybe because it confirms my own opinions, but one of the arguments is his standard, according to which, under what particular circumstances the federal government may in fact be in contact with social media companies, seems arbitrary and random, almost to the point where it's designed specifically to generate the kind of outcome in the case that he'd like to see.
Yeah, so I don't agree with that. I like the ruling. The ruling as written has, I think, like 9 different kinds of interventions that the federal government is prohibited from doing with social media companies. They can still, for instance, go talk to social media companies and tell them, look, we've identified a child porn ring. You should probably get rid of that. We've identified fraudulent activity on your servers. You should probably get rid of that. Here's some criminals that are preying on people. They're still allowed to do those kinds of activities. What they're not allowed to do are the kinds of things that they did, which is to target American citizens who are engaged in legal speech and then tell the social media companies that you ought to censor these people and these ideas because they're so dangerous that they're going to cause deaths or whatever excuse they want to use. Ironically, of course, their policies cause deaths. In fact, that's a really important part of the ruling. So if you're going to say the word harmed, we're talking about harming of people at scale from the policies. And then, but the government followed with these lockdowns. And then they're going to use their power over the internet to control and reduce the effective criticism of those policies. I mean, that's real harm. Just to get back to the specifics of the question, the July 4th ruling essentially also forbade the federal government from deploying proxies, cutouts, private proxies like the Stanford Internet Observatory, and saying to them, look, why don't you design the censorship agenda? So Dowdy said to the government, you can't go to social media companies and ask them to censor with implied threats underneath. And also, you can't go to private entities, NGOs, universities, and generate the censorship agenda as a way of getting around the American First Amendment, saying, oh, it's private entities that are doing it. The appeals court, what it did, it looks like it narrowed the ruling in like a whole bunch of ways. But really, the most important way it narrowed the ruling was it said that while the federal government is still not allowed to go to social media companies and say, you must censor these people and these ideas, the district court, the appellate court ruling, agreed with that aspect of it. They scaled back the second thing, which is that the federal government isn't allowed to go essentially develop a censorship agenda using private cutouts. Under the appeals court ruling, that's still allowed. The Supreme Court, at this point, essentially stayed the ruling while it wants to hear all the arguments. The arguments then will be heard, I think, sometime in the winter or spring, early spring or winter of 2024 coming up. So we should know in a few months what directions this is going to go. As it stands, if the Supreme Court rules with the Biden administration, the American First Amendment is dead. And the ability for private citizens to criticize government policy using legal speech is greatly limited because the government can just essentially go and put you on a blacklist.
Now, again, I want to play devil's advocate here. They would say that we're not just arbitrarily restricting people's ability to speak. We're focusing like a laser beam on types of speech that could endanger a great many people. Now, you may disagree with us that the speech would endanger a great many people, but we have the preponderance of scientific opinion on our side that people shouldn't be on Twitter, let's say, telling people to take such and such medicine for COVID, or they shouldn't be telling people not to wear masks. And we believe that these are examples of very, very dangerous forms of misinformation that could have great harm, that could cause great harm. Now, we can respond to that in two ways. Number one, we can address the merits of the things being censored. Like, for example, I think a lot of people, their opinions on the effectiveness of masks changed over time as they looked at real world evidence and more data began to be assembled. I think there's much less confidence in their effectiveness now than there was before. So when was I allowed to say that they're not as effective as you think they are? Like, at what point was I suddenly allowed to say that? Or we can just speak on the principle of the thing that, unfortunately, in a free society, you know, maybe some people do say some things that are false. But the problem is, if you try to correct that, who gets to do the correcting? That's the question we get no answer to. Or if it's, quote, the scientific consensus said to put everybody on a ventilator in early 2020.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you give a nice articulation of the devil's advocate view, but you also answered your devil's advocate.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I couldn't help myself, Jay. I couldn't help it.
I mean, I think let's look at that as carefully as we can and honestly as we can, all right? So the idea is that somehow the federal government has in its employ a set of people who are so wise and so perspicacious that they can see forward into time about which direction every single scientific debate is going to go. And then in advance, suppress the people that will take the wrong side of it, right? So probably this is best personified by someone like Tony Fauci, who gave an interview, I think, to CNN, where he bragged that if you criticize me, you are not simply criticizing a man, you are criticizing science itself. Mm. The premise then is that the federal government has essentially a church-like power to tell the difference between sheep and goats, you know, like the people who are going to be condemned to hell, the people who are going to go to heaven. They can decree from on high the outcome of scientific debates that are still ongoing. Even if you believe that it's true that they have better scientific knowledge than the assembled masses, they might be wrong. I mean, the way science works, and you already presaged the answer to this, it's very commonly the case that the scientific consensus one day is overturned basically overnight by a whole series of facts. And if you act on the false scientific consensus at scale with the power of a government to close businesses, keep kids out of school for 2 years, to essentially interdict international trade for years on end, cause mass panic and fear at scale, what's going to happen is a great deal of harm, a great deal of damage is going to be done to people. And now, it is absolutely true that the assembled masses may say things that are scientifically false. That is absolutely true. And as a price that is actually, for sure, a price, just to be honest, a price of free speech, that there may be people who say false things that gain an audience. To me, the right way to counter that is, if I'm in charge of the CDC or something, is not to censor those people and say, look, these people need to be thrown into the gulag. In effect, metaphorically. The right way to counter those people is by better arguments. And over a long period of time, what happens is if you are honest, if an entity like the CDC is honest about the strengths and limitations of the evidence that they're saying and the recommendations they're giving, they treat people like adults, they will generate trust. And so it'll be much easier to counter people that are saying false things. I think there's an irony here. If the government were to act with humility on these scientific matters, to communicate as if the people that they rule over our co-rulers, our citizens, rather than of subjects, the people would trust the government more than otherwise. It takes time and it takes subtlety to build that trust. And what we've seen during the pandemic is by this act of censorship, the government has burned all trust. I can say just on my own personal behalf, I once upon a time thought the CDC wasn't a trusted entity, that the NIH was a trusted entity, that the FDA was a trusted entity. And I have lost all trust in all three entities to say basic scientific truths. And I think the American public at large, I've never seen public trust in public health at such a low ebb in my professional lifetime. And it is exactly because of the activities, the censorship activities, the abuse of power by the government on these scientific matters. So I think that's the central answer. If you really want to counter misinformation, you have to do it by building trust. And these activities destroy trust. These kinds of, the ability for the government to censor at scale destroy trust.
I'd like to thank our sponsor, CrowdHealth. If there's somebody out there who doesn't find American health insurance frustrating and expensive, I don't know who it is. Not to mention claims denials are getting more common. Last year, 1 in 5 Obamacare claims were denied. Well, that's why CrowdHealth was created. It's not health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. Because let's face it, your insurance policy is opaque and full of, shall we say, unpleasant surprises, and your premiums are going up every year. You wind up feeling taken advantage of. Well, CrowdHealth is doing things differently. For $175 for an individual or $575 for a family of 4 or more, you'll get access to a community of people who are willing to help out in the event of an emergency. And you'll get access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, and so much more without doctors' networks getting in the way. And of course, you'll join the crowd, a group of members just like you who want to help pay for each other's unexpected medical events. Let CrowdHealth help with your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $99 per month for your first 3 months. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. This is probably going to seem frivolous, Jay, but I've actually kind of wondered in the back of my mind. I wonder if, given now how high profile you are and people like Martin Kulldorff, who also was mentioned by name, I wonder if maybe at least one or two of the big tech platforms is now doing the opposite with you. In effect, they don't want to call further attention to what's been done in the past. They're going to leave Jay Bhattacharya alone from now on. I wonder if you have like super protection now. It would embarrass the Biden administration for you to have more evidence to be able to bring to bear.
Well, I do think as a plaintiff in the case, it makes it much easier to highlight, because, you know, in open court, they can't censor. When they do censor, every time we see an instance that we'll do that. But I think that, for instance, I think the fact that Elon contacted me directly in 2022 when he bought Twitter is an indication that there's some counter movement in among the tech platforms, at least one of the tech platforms, to try to reduce the amount of, but, you know, like Scott Atlas, for instance, former advisor to the president of President Trump on COVID matters in July and August and September 2020. He was just the other day gave a talk at Colorado University, essentially outlining the evidence that COVID lockdown policies had both failed to protect vulnerable people and harm people at scale. He has this slide deck, this fantastic slide deck where he goes through the sort of chapter and verse of evidence on this. That talk was videotaped. It was at a university and put on YouTube by Colorado University, and YouTube pulled the video down. And that's November 2023. There may still be a blacklist. I know during the time that we have had this stay in the ruling prohibiting the Biden administration from violating the First Amendment, the Biden administration is, I think, still using its power to violate the First Amendment for people as prominent as Dr. Scott Atlas. So it's not enough to have, I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, Jay can talk and Martin can talk, and that's great. The problem is if it's just us talking, it's very easy to point to us as fringe figures because everyone else is censored. And we're not fringe figures. What I've learned, I think, is, you know, actually, if you asked me in 2020, was I saying something that was on the margins of what scientists were saying? I would have agreed with you because I myself was fooled I thought that the vast majority of scientists agreed with Dr. Fauci, but that they were wrong. In retrospect, I think what happened is that very few scientists actually agree with Dr. Fauci. They were allowed and put in front of the public all the time. Most of scientists, they were essentially scared to say their reservations because they saw what happened to people like me, to what happened to Martin and Sinetra, essentially being cast out as heretics, or to Dr. Atlas. And because we were cast out as heretics, it sent a warning to all these other scientists that might have agreed with us to say, like, yeah, you better be quiet, or else the nasty things might happen to your career. The government abused its power to create an illusion of consensus around its ideas about lockdown. And that I think is the central story here. When you allow the government to have this power, you can't even tell what the consensus actually is. In science, there really isn't this idea of like consensus. It may be true that many scientists agree on something, but it may still be wrong. I mean, that's the premise of science. If the Supreme Court rules that the Biden administration can violate the First Amendment, it's not just that the First Amendment is dead. It's that the scientific process in the United States is dead, right? You can very easily have a government that decides that there is some idea so outside the bounds that no scientist is allowed to even do experiments on it. Now, I'm not saying that there can't be topics like that. There could be, for instance, there's a ban on nuclear weapons testing, above ground nuclear weapons testing, right? There you have prudential reasons why it might harm the public to be exposed to the radiation from testing above ground, and various reasons why you might want that to happen so that you can limit some kinds of scientific experiments. But those are openly discussed and debated. Those are not quietly censored behind the scenes with people put on blacklists that want to advocate for the, we're about to have this argument over gain of function work, right? Should we ban? But again, these are not like blacklists. These are, should the government be supporting work like this? Is some scientific work so dangerous that we as a society agree not to do it? That we do that openly as a society, not sort of in the shadows behind the veil, trying to say, okay, let's take out these scientists, excommunicate them simply because they're saying heretical ideas. Two very different processes.
Well, now I have a question that, again, you probably didn't anticipate having to answer, let's say 4 years ago, but suppose a young person comes to you and says, I'd like to go into medicine. And maybe this person happens to have opinions close to yours. What kind of advice would you give?
I'm a dad, so I have this like fatherly instinct to like want to like tell the young people that come to me for advice, fatherly things. Like, I don't want them to get their heads chopped off. I don't want them to like have a career filled with strife. I want them to have a happy life. And the kinds of environment that we made, heretical scientists are not going to have a happy life. And so I kind of want to tell them as a father, I want to give them that warning. At the same time, if I see a courageous young person wanting to say different things, even challenge me, as a teacher, that fills me with joy. As someone who wants to train the next generation of health policy people, of health economists, of epidemiologists, I want those young people to see how amazing the fields that I'm studying are in and how broad they are. And I want them to make new advances so that I can learn from them. So I'm kind of conflicted, Tom. On the one hand, I want them to enter a healthy scientific debate, a healthy field of science that's amenable to debate and that allows for them to overturn orthodoxies with their scientific discoveries. But I look at the state of American science, and what I see is anyone who dares to do that, at least in the fields that I'm in, they're going to be put on blacklists. And it's the American government that basically has set the tone for that by engaging in these activities that violate the American First Amendment. So if you want to do that, honestly, I don't know what to tell them. I feel like I'm consigning them to a life of difficulty if I encourage them to enter the fields that I'm in. But at the same time, I'm thrilled that there are people that want to enter, because I think the fields themselves are really, really important, really interesting, and important to the, not just intellectually, but to the lives and well-beings of the world's people.
Let me ask you this. I've heard a lot about medical research fraud. I've heard a lot of high-profile people saying that it's a genuine problem, and not just in traditional, what we associate it with medicine, but in psychology also. Obviously, there was the replication crisis. So do you think, this is a completely separate issue, but I'm going to bring it back to this. Do you think there is an issue with published research? I mean, I know you have a colleague at Stanford who wrote a famous article about maybe half of published research being wrong. Do you think that's a problem that persists?
Yes, I think it is a major problem. I have to say, though, I think if you look back at scientific history, I think it's always been like that. The difference now is that people have a very strong career incentive to publish essentially meaningless work. And the instances where people identify fraud, I think, are just the tip of it. A lot of work is not fraud, but it's just simply wrong. But I think people have had an incentive, if you've entered science basically since science has gone on, to like put forward ideas that turn out to be wrong. Half of scientific literature, even before the modern age, was wrong, I think, or more. So I don't think that's unique. What's unique is the social power given to consensus in science and the ability for powerful entities like governments to use that social power to enact policies that otherwise would have no chance of being enacted. The lockdowns are a fantastic example of this, right? Using the idea that every scientist agrees that we have to lock down or else millions of people will die. If the government essentially enacted policies that violated civil liberties at scale, destroyed the lives of poor people, of children, of working class people, and especially poor people in poor countries, destroyed the lives of countless people on the premise that there was scientific consensus based on the peer-reviewed scientific literature. The problem then is that you take a scientific literature that is inherently going to have wrong ideas in it. Science is difficult. It takes a long time to sort out true from false, and it takes a healthy scientific ecosystem that allows dissent for that to occur, right? So you have this healthy debate going on at the edge of science in every field, but then you have on the other side powerful government entities that will use its muscle to say, look, these guys are heretics. We need to put Galileo in jail, in house arrest or whatever. And the scientists themselves get involved with this, right? So you have powerful scientists toadying up to the powerful scientific bureaucrats saying, look, Jay's a fringe epidemiologist. There's an email that showed up in FOIA from a colleague of mine here writing to Francis Collins and Tony Fauci calling me a fringe epidemiologist, not even an epidemiologist. Because what? He wants power here at Stanford, right? Or he wants power. Essentially, it's like people understand when there's power, the fact that there are wrong ideas will be abused. And that's essentially what has happened. I think that's the real danger.
Yeah.
So the abuse of the social power of science in order to enact policies that would have no chance otherwise. The only defense against that is debate.
Of course. And so it sounds like one of the risks is that since science is very often a work in progress, if you interrupt that work at some arbitrary moment and say, well, we'll take a snapshot of the state of science in this area at this moment, and here's where the consensus is, and then we're going to build up this consensus and demonize everybody else, that's not going to be good for anybody. And so that's why I brought up this issue, is my fear that that kind of thing, that science now becomes increasingly politicized, because now we're just used to seeing scientists speaking at White House events, and it just seems normal that there's a relationship between government and science, and it's normal for the government to privilege one group of scientists over another. It seems like this is going to stop science in its tracks. And maybe sometimes the consensus is right, and subsidies in that case, you know, maybe you could argue they have some benefit, but who knows, unfortunately.
I mean, I think you can make an argument, an economic argument, for public involvement in science, right? So you can make for instance, the NIH, I think, solves a market failure. I saw it potentially. If you have an idea that has positive externalities, right? So like the structure of DNA, there's no real good way to patent that idea. And yet knowing the structure of DNA is an incredibly valuable thing for everybody that does biology. And so you can make an argument, or for instance, randomized trials on cheap drugs that are off patent. No one has any incentive to develop knowledge about those drugs. And so there's a market failure in knowledge production. So you could say, well, look, I want the NIH to focus on its investments on areas that are not patentable, areas that are not ownable, like the idea of the structure of DNA, because there's going to be underinvestments in those and there's positive externalities. So you can make an argument like that. But then if you're going to have an agency like that, it can't then abuse its power. Because once it does that, then you've created this negative consequence that I think just swamps whatever benefit you get from the solving of this market failure problem. essentially you have people like Tony Fauci say, I know the truth. I am the truth. If you contradict me, you're contradicting obviously the truth because I embody the truth, right? And then all of a sudden they're not using public resources to solve a market failure. They're using public resources to put themselves at the center of policy debates as if they were the high pope and directing resources to, you know, essentially toadies that agree with them. That's the problem. Like, we have something that I think you can make a defensible case in favor of it, of government intervention, but that the government essentially deploying that power to undermine the very process of science itself. And the First Amendment, which is this case, this First Amendment case, I think is the heart of the problem here, right? If Tony Fauci actually didn't have the power to marginalize scientists, I mean, he does by his funding decisions, but let's say he didn't also have the power to like have social media and regular media slag scientists that disagree with him, he would be much less powerful. It'd just be simply, you know, an inside or outsider problem. There'd be inside scientists who would like get funding, and there'd be outsider scientists, presumably from, there'd be other sources of money and power, private money and private power. If the issue is important enough, funding scientists on the outside, there'd be some battle between of ideas between the government scientists and the outside scientists. I mean, that's not ideal either, but like you could, that at least you can see some possibility of a good social outcome or some positive progress. Here you have, it's much worse. You have the government essentially marginalizing any outside scientist that disagrees with them. Forget about not funding them. And they have, and you know, and the social power they have is tremendous, Tom, right? So I have a professorship at Stanford, a tenured professorship at Stanford. I don't earn it in the medical school. I don't earn it unless I have been successful at getting NIH grants. It's partly because I've been successful in NIH grant funding that I have the position I have. So, and other scientists see this. They see that it's not just that someone like Tony Fauci can control whether they get money for their experiments, but they control where they are in the hierarchy of science itself. And so they say silent. It's a tremendous power that's abused. And then you put it on top of that, the censorship power. It's just, science can't work in that setting. It's just dead in that setting. And we desperately need reform.
Yeah, but the problem is that's just it. I mean, the system has gone on like this, I think, for most people undetected because there was no COVID in the headlines for 3 years. So most people don't know what's going on. And maybe even people within the system feel like the system is more or less benign. But now that we've seen this episode, we can never unsee it. And it makes us wonder, well, what else has been going on? What other unworthy things have these people been doing? There's so much, I don't know, inertia, let's say. And everybody just sort of accepts this is how it works. Even if you get somebody who comes in and changes the personnel at the top, then somebody else could come in and change the personnel at the top. It seems like a really difficult problem.
It's structural, right? And so reform then requires structural reform. You can't have the NIH structured the way it is. Like one idea I've had is to, because, you know, like what's the solution to market power is competition, right? That you want to try to introduce competition. So maybe you can introduce competition, scientific competition within the government itself, right? If you're going to have an NIH, then what you do is you don't have one NIH, you have multiple NIHs, right? So you have regional NIHs, for instance, that compete with each other. Once upon a time, there were in economics, there were essentially regional schools, right? There's the Chicago school, the Austrian school. There were all these, a lot of what's happened in modern economics is that a lot of the universities essentially has become homogenized. So there's much less competition of basic fundamental ideas. There were Marxists. I mean, lots of people I disagreed with, but they would fight with each other when I first entered economics and at least have some oxygen. Now that the oxygen is completely gone, all you have is essentially a small consensus. It's a very unhealthy kind of field. I think you have the same kind of problem generally in biomedical sciences because it's the oxygen is sucked out of it by the NIH. If you're going to reform the NIH, it has to be structural. You can never again have a person with so much power, like a 40-year leader, like you know, someone who's been at the top of the hierarchy, like Tony Fauci. Essentially, like it's like J. Edgar Hoover in front. It was just uncancelled, you know, someone that was so essential that had all the reins of power that was ripe for abuse. You have to, it's not, so you're right, Tom. It's not simply replacing that single individual. It's changing the structure of the institution so that it can never produce that kind of power ever again. It should be focused on deciding what scientific ideas ought to be funded. And I think it should be focused on ideas, funding scientific ideas that wouldn't be able to get support in the public sector because of these positive externalities we talked about. I think that would be, if you could restructure the NIH around that with competition among different scientific schools so that people of very different views can get funding, I think that might be a healthier NIH. Let me give you one anecdote that I have from my experience as an NIH reviewer. Like, I spent 2 decades on NIH grant review panels. And what I saw was it was very, very easy for scientists to kill new ideas. Somebody has an idea from some perspective that seems threatening to their own field. As a scientific reviewer, you can just say, well, I don't like this, and it's dead. There's a requirement, at least there was for a long time, that you had to have NIH grants to serve as a scientific reviewer, with the premise that if you don't have an NIH grant, you're not qualified to judge NIH grants. Well, that guarantees only insiders will win. So you need fundamental structural reform in the way the NIH operates if it's going to serve a legitimate public purpose without the abuse of power that it engaged in during the pandemic and before.
Hey folks, quick message from our outstanding sponsor, Policy Genius. At the holidays and particularly New Year's Day, we look toward the future. And as we do so, we should think about our family's future and how we can best secure it. Life insurance provides a safety net. So if something were to happen to you, your family can cover expenses while getting back on their feet. And Policy Genius will help you do just that. I have tremendous peace of mind because my family is fully provided for with my life insurance policy, and it is much less expensive than you think. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Now, even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, it may not offer enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. Policy Genius also knows how valuable your time is, so with just a few clicks, you'll be comparing quotes from top insurers and finding your lowest price. The licensed, award-winning agents at Policy Genius can help you find the best fit for your needs. They work for you, not the insurance companies, so they don't have an incentive to favor one insurer over another. And that means you can trust their guidance. No wonder they have thousands of 5-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot. Your family deserves peace of mind. A life insurance policy through Policy Genius can give it to them. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Are we planning to write that book?
Yes, I am, Tom. So I've written a couple of the hardest chapters. In fact, I published the one is in a Tablet magazine article, How Stanford Failed the Academic Freedom Test, and another in Paul Thacker's Disillusioned Chronicles, essentially talking about my early work with the seroprevalence studies, measuring the antibody levels in the population, and how the scientific community and Stanford actually did a number on it, essentially trying to destroy my reputation for just having run a study. So I've written, those were the hardest chapters, because they involve talking about people that I loved and trusted, but betraying me.
Well, if I'm sorry to interrupt, but that was how I first got to know you, because I saw you interviewed about that work very early on. And what I liked about it was not only that you sounded credible, but you also had a very even temper and a very scientific, if I may say so, disposition. And you had no trace of panic in your voice. You seemed like somebody speaking from authority. And that was, I think, what a lot of people wanted at that time. There was plenty of panic already. You know, you sounded like somebody who had confidently examined the data and was just calmly reporting what he had found. And I thought, I would love to hear more voices like this.
I mean, I thought I was just doing science when I did that study. That was like April 2020. I thought I was just, it was, you know, I'd never been in the public eye before. And so I just didn't have any notion of how you're supposed to act in the public eye. I hope I'm still like that. I still have temperament toward that. I want to be a scientist. That's my main goal. But I think what happened in response to that was just completely outside my expectations. It entirely disillusioned me about my institute, my home institution that I've been here. And I've been here for 37 years. It made me, I went through a period after that where, because of the attacks on me, the very, very unfair attacks, both at the university and outside, why was I like this state of anxiety for a full month? I forgot to eat. I couldn't sleep.
Oh, awful.
I lost 30 pounds. At one point, I was going to write this book, How to Lose 30 Pounds During a Pandemic. but that's not the
Everybody
right way
else
to
is putting on weight.
It was pretty bad. It was an awful time in my life. And so I've written those two hardest chapters. It took me 2 years to write them. I have a lot of other chapters that involve much happier things, including actually the Great Barrington Declaration. So I'm going to write those. I'm hoping next year to finish the writing of it. But it's just, I'm used to writing scientific papers, Tom, not memoirs. And I think just sitting here trying to say, okay, I don't usually like to make myself the story, but I think in a memoir.
But unfortunately, you are in this case, you are the story.
Yeah, I think you have to do that just to make it interesting. So, but I do want to make sure that it's fair to people who criticize me. It's fair to people who were on my side, or my allies on my side, and to tell that, because I've spoken with presidents, I've met the Pope, I met cardinals and prime ministers, and been advisors to governors. It's been an absolutely outside of my expectations in terms of the ability to communicate ideas to very, very important people. And also just to talk to regular people. That's huge numbers of regular people have written to me telling me their stories. So I want some of that in there too, just because if it's just my story, it'll bore me. If it can tell a story about other people and the time we went through, and then just give some glimpse of this, that's what I'd like to be able to do with the book. 2024.
Well, I know that around the time, but I don't know if it was around the time he retired, but there was some kind of documentary about Dr. Fauci. And I remember thinking, I'd like to see a documentary about Dr. Bhattacharya. I'd like to see about his life. And who should play him in the movie and all that. But, you know, we don't always get the things we want in this world. But the very, very next best thing would be the J. Bhattacharya book. Well, of course, folks, if you don't live in the New York City area, you can watch a live stream of this event. And if you don't watch the live stream, which would be sad because it's very exciting to watch these live streams, there is a whole podcast dedicated to the recordings of the Soho Forum debates. So you can, wherever you find podcasts, go to Soho Forum Debates. But for this thing, try to be there in person if you can. It'll be very interesting and stimulating. December 17th, 2023, thesohoforum.org for information. Well, Jay, if there's anything else you'd like us to link to, of course, in the description, I will put your Twitter so people can follow you there. I'm still old-fashioned. I still call it Twitter. But if there's any other link, I'm glad to insert it. Oh, your podcast and your Substack.
Yeah, this Illusion of Consensus podcast with Rav Arora. Illusion, I think it's illusionconsensus.com.
Yes.
It's at Substack. I've been trying to interview a whole bunch of really interesting people, some less well-known, some more well-known, who've had ideas during the pandemic that were, some of which I agree with, some of which I disagreed with. The context of the podcast, the reason it's called Illusion of Consensus, is to show people that there really isn't a consensus like this. There wasn't on COVID and on a whole bunch of other scientific matters. So it's a fun podcast, and it's with Rav Arora, who's a young journalist in British Columbia. And he has, you know, like, he's my son's age, so it's fun to interact with someone.
I had
like
him
that.
On my show. He was great.
Yeah.
So, all right, so I'll definitely urge people to do that. So illusionconsensus.com is where you can find all this. I'll also link to that. Well, Jay, I think I've kept you more than the customary amount of time, so I appreciate you very much for this and for your work and for all your ongoing struggles, but you are heading for the finish line, and it looks like after, my instinct tells me that after all these struggles and injustices, that at least to some degree, you are headed toward vindication.
Tom, I appreciate that. And also, I appreciate your letting me read your book early. It was just a wonderful, there were a lot of painful things that you wrote about, painful times to remember, but you wrote about it in such a charming way. I hope everyone gets to read your book.
Thank you. Thank you. It's Jay was kind enough to write the foreword for it. Called Diary of a Psychosis. It has just come out, so go check that out. Also link to that. I've got a link to my own thing in the description too. Thanks so much, Jay, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.